HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Happier No Matter What, Cultivating Hope, Resilience, and Purpose in Hard Times by Tal Ben-Shahar. Read by Adam Werner. Introduction. Happier No Matter What. To me, the only satisfactory definition of happiness is wholeness. Helen Keller. So, Tal, shouldn't we quarantine happiness now? My friend asked me. He was only half-joking. We were deep into the coronavirus pandemic that swept the world. Undeniably, the COVID-19 crisis brought on a particularly intense series of challenges. Perhaps you got sick, feared becoming ill, or even endured the unimaginable pain of a loved one's death. Perhaps you suffered the loss of your job. Parents struggled to balance the competing responsibilities of work and childcare. Families and teachers agonized over whether it was safe to attend school. And we all felt the malaise of being isolated from friends and loved ones. For many, as stresses mounted, the fog of depression set in. Simple activities that we took for granted and used to turn to for relaxation vanished overnight. Like going out to dinner or seeing a play, and the joyous celebrations we looked forward to, like vacations and weddings, were suddenly canceled. As we masked our faces to protect ourselves and others from the virus, it became even hard to share a smile with a stranger while walking down the street. In the midst of this new reality, what was the relevance of studying happiness? From the time the coronavirus saga started, many people have echoed my friend's sentiment that perhaps we should quarantine happiness, and that the science of happiness should be put on hold for a while. They figured, sure, once things are back to normal, we can look at happiness again, but given everything going on in the world right now, shouldn't we press pause? And my answer to that is no. We shouldn't quarantine happiness. We definitely shouldn't put it on hold. In fact, in challenging times, whatever they may be, studying the science of happiness is more vital and relevant than ever. Growing from hardship. We can roughly situate all human experiences along a continuum spanning from negative, through neutral, to positive. For example, pain, suffering, misfortune, and hardship fall on the negative end, while pleasure, joy, fortune, and comfort belong on the positive end. Right in the middle, we have the zero point, the I'm doing okay point. Many people believe that the role of the science of happiness is to deal with anything from neutral to positive. In other words, as long as you're doing okay or better, you can benefit from the research findings in the field. And if you're not doing well, if you're sad or anxious, going through hard times and struggling, well, only psychotherapy or medication can help. Of course, I fully support seeking professional care. Therapy can help whether we're doing fine overall or when our life feels out of control. Medication, such as antidepressants or anti-anxiety drugs, has saved lives, and I would never recommend anyone stop medications without consulting with their physician. But the notion of having to reach neutral before one can benefit from the science of happiness is flawed. The science of happiness is relevant for the entire spectrum of human experiences. Yes, it can certainly help us go from a 3 to a 5, from doing fine to doing really well. But it's even more beneficial when we're at -3 or -5. It can help us bounce back and even launch us beyond. Why? Because the science of happiness strengthens our psychological immune system. Needless to say, bolstering your psychological immune system, or your biological immune system for that matter, doesn't mean you won't get sick. It simply means you'll get sick less often. And when you do, you'll recover more promptly. The science of happiness can help you become happier, even if slightly so, no matter where you are along the spectrum. It also equips you to be better able to deal with difficulties and hardships when they arise. In fact, with a strong psychological immune system, you could go a step beyond resilience. You could become anti-fragile, what I think of as resilience 2.0. Anti-fragile is a concept that was introduced by writer, epistemologist, and statistician Nassim Taleb, a professor at New York University. To understand anti-fragile, we need to start with resilience, a term taken from engineering. A particular substance or material is considered resilient if it returns to its original form after enduring stress or pressure. Along similar lines, to explain resilience, we use the metaphor of a ball dropping and then bouncing back to its original point. According to Taleb, a substance or a material is anti-fragile if, after enduring stress or pressure, it doesn't merely return to its original state, but grows stronger as a result. If a resilient ball bounces back to where it was before, an anti-fragile ball bounces back higher. More generally, an anti-fragile system, and that could be an inanimate object, or a living entity in the form of a person, a relationship, a group of people, or even a nation, goes through hardship and consequently grows stronger, better, happier. When Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century German philosopher, wrote that whatever does not kill me makes me stronger, he was describing anti-fragility. And indeed, you can grow from adversity and experience anti-fragility, even if you have gone through extreme hardship. Trauma can pull us down or raise us up, leave us weaker or make us stronger. In fact, research by psychologists Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun at the University of North Carolina suggests that people faced with hardships are more likely to experience post-traumatic growth, PTG, than post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Most of us have heard of PTSD, which can include painful consequences like reliving the trauma, anxiety, and depression, difficulty concentrating, and trouble sleeping. But there is another potential enduring experience, a beneficial one, and that is PTG. Nothing, unfortunately, can guarantee growth after trauma. However, there are certain conditions we can put in place to significantly increase the likelihood of that outcome. As I see it, a central objective of the science of happiness is to help individuals, families, organizations, and communities understand and apply these conditions, and thereby grow from the difficulties associated with the pandemic or any other hardship. There is much that we can do to become more anti-fragile. From research to me-search. I wrote this book so that you can have something to anchor you during tumultuous times, ideas that you can hang on to and, most important, experiment with. I'm a psychologist and an academic. In my profession, I draw on research a great deal. However, even more essential than research is me-search. Research is about looking at what other people have done, evaluating their actions, and learning from the result. Me-search is doing the same for the self, looking inside, experimenting with change. I'm a big fan of biographies. There's much that we can learn from them, especially biographies of people who have done special and extraordinary things. One of my favorites is that of revered Indian leader and activist Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi's autobiography is subtitled "The Story of My Experiments with Truth." Notice the language. It's not "my finding truth." It's not "my discovery of truth." It's "my experiments with truth." Throughout his life, standing up for social justice, Gandhi experimented. He tried things. And this is what I would like you to do as you make your way through this book. Yes, you will learn about a lot of happiness research. Yes, you'll find tips for incorporating these ideas in your life. But more than anything, I'd like you to play with these ideas and tips and see how things work for you. Some of the strategies may be highly relevant for you at this point in your journey, some may be relevant for you in the future, and some may not be relevant at all. But it's difficult to know without trying. Particularly in uncertain times, there's a lot of advice out there on what we should and shouldn't do, whether it's as parents or as employees, whether it's on the personal level or professional. With this book, I hope to distill some evidence-based information so that you can me-search based on psychological studies and create a bit of order amid the chaos. I want to give you strategies that you can apply and that will help you become happier, now. I started to study happiness because of my unhappiness. I'm not sure whether I passed the clinical threshold for depression or anxiety, but I certainly experienced sadness and stress much of the time. That's what led to my interest in positive psychology. 30 years later, people ask me, "So are you finally happy now?" And my answer to this question is, I don't know. What I do know is that I am happier. As you will learn in this book, the purpose of building anti-fragility is not to lead you to the happily ever after. I don't believe happily ever after exists. Happiness and unhappiness are not fixed or binary conditions. There isn't a point before which we are unhappy and after which we are happy. Happiness resides on a continuum. I've made a lot of progress over the last 30 years on that continuum, and I certainly hope that 5 or 10 years from now I'll be happier than I am today, and that you will be too. This is why this book is titled Happier No Matter What, rather than Happy No Matter What. It's a lifelong journey, one that ends when life ends. The Myth of Success and Happiness. What exactly is happiness, anyway? Why is it important? And how do we obtain it? Before we go into definitions, let me share with you a few studies that point to a profound and pervasive misunderstanding about happiness, its role in our lives, and how to get it. Most people believe that the path to happiness is through success. If only I could achieve my dream, attain this goal, reach that milestone, I would be happy. Or following some significant failure, we think, my dream is over. Everything is ruined. I didn't make it. I'll never be happy now. According to this formula, success is the cause. Happiness is the effect. It turns out, though, that this is wrong. Not a little wrong, but very wrong. There are numerous studies that challenge the formula that success leads to happiness. For example, Harvard professor Daniel Gilbert studied college professors at the most important point in their career, just as they were about to hear whether they would receive tenure. When Gilbert asked the professors how they would feel after the tenure decision was made, most predicted that if they received tenure, they would enjoy lasting happiness, and if they were turned down, they would be crushed for a long time to come. After all, tenure is considered the holy grail for professors. Often a 15-year process, tenure means lifetime employment. It means not being under pressure to publish all the time anymore. It means you get to stay at your university. What actually happened after the decisions were announced? While those professors who received tenure were ecstatic upon hearing the news, and those who were denied tenure were understandably devastated, the major event had little consequences in the long term for how happy or unhappy they were. In other words, the professors grossly overestimated the impact of a major success, or failure, on their happiness. The event, perceived by most professors as so significant and potentially life-changing, led to a temporary high or a temporary low. That's it. Similar studies have been conducted on lottery winners. How many of us imagine that if we won the lottery, everything would forever change, for the better? Despite the windfall, it turns out that's not what happens. Lottery winners experience an extreme high when they win, just like the tenured professors. But they go back to where they were before. The winners who had been unhappy usually returned to being unhappy after experiencing a short spike in their happiness levels. No change. The same goes on for other big life events, like our wedding day or losing our job. More often than not, we experience a temporary high or temporary low, and then go back to where we were before the event on the happiness continuum. I once informally conducted a poll among my students when I was teaching at Harvard. I had around 1,000 students in the class, and I asked them to think back to April 2nd of the previous spring or the years prior. Why April 2nd? Because that was the day when college acceptance letters used to arrive in the mail. These days it's by email, telling you, congratulations, you're in, or, we're sorry, our class was very competitive this year. Given that the students were sitting in my class, of course they had all been accepted. I then said to them, please put your hand up if on April 2nd You were anywhere between very happy and ecstatic. Just about every hand went up. Then I said, please leave your hand up if on April 2nd you thought that you would be happy for the rest of your lives. Almost all hands stayed up. Why? Because that's what they were told and consequently believed when they were in high school. Sure, you may be struggling, stressed out, and even miserable now, but if you get into one of your top choices for college, it will forever have been worth it. Then I said, okay, now leave your hand up if today you're happy. I didn't say very happy. I didn't say ecstatic. I just said happy. Most students put their hands down. The majority of college students around the United States experience stress and are overwhelmed by everything that they have to do. Levels of depression are skyrocketing among teenagers and young adults, and this state of affairs was well underway before the onset of the coronavirus. It's not looking good when it comes to mental health. And yet people continue to believe that success will lead them to the land of happiness. It won't. Successes do lead you to experiencing highs, while failures lead you to experiencing lows. However, these fluctuations are fleeting, and in and of themselves are not the building blocks of a happy or unhappy life. Does that mean there isn't a relationship between success and happiness? No. In fact, there's a very strong relationship, but it's the opposite of what most people think. It's not success that leads to happiness. Rather, it is that happiness leads to success. Why happiness matters. Psychologists and organizational scholars consistently demonstrate that if you increase your levels of well-being, even by a little bit, you become a great deal more successful. And by successful, I mean not only in the traditional sense of goal achievement, but also in a much broader, multidimensional sense. You'll be more successful as a parent, as a partner, as an employee, as a coach, and as a friend. By increasing happiness levels even slightly, you become more creative and more innovative, whether in the workplace as an adult or in school as a child. Productivity and engagement levels at work and in school increase significantly in tandem with an increase in well-being. Increasing happiness levels makes us kinder and more generous and reduces the likelihood of violence and immoral behavior in general. Our mental and physiological immune systems are linked, and increasing happiness levels fortifies our psychological resilience as well as boosts our physical resilience. Happy people are healthier, better able to ward off disease and controlling for all other factors, live longer. And we're not the only ones who benefit when we enjoy an increase in our happiness levels. Happiness improves our relationships, which is even more important when so many of us are remaining in one place, often with the same people, for extended periods of time. But that's not to say that one's being happy eliminates having any conflict at home. You will still experience discontent. You will have disagreements. There may be days when you want to tear your hair out and you can't stand being in such close proximity with the same people. That's okay. That's all part of the being human deal. However, even a little boost to well-being means you will have fewer relationship challenges, and when you do, you'll be better equipped to deal with them. Moreover, given that happiness is contagious, by increasing your own happiness, you help those around you become happier, thus contributing to a happier world, a world that is better, healthier, and more moral. What is happiness? I'm sure it won't surprise you that happiness has no single agreed-upon definition. In fact, there are probably as many characterizations of happiness as there are human beings, which has led many people, including experts in the field, to argue that happiness is like beauty. You know it when you see it or experience it. Nevertheless, I maintain that it is important to define happiness for the purpose of understanding it, pursuing it, and attaining it. You may not agree with my definition, and that's fine. I'm not claiming an ultimate truth here. So, whether you use my definition or another, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you think about what happiness is for you, and then break it down, and understand how you can attain it. The definition I propose, developed with my colleagues Megan McDonough and Maria Surah, derives from the work of Helen Keller, who wrote early in the 20th century, "To me, the only satisfactory definition of happiness is wholeness." Expanding on Keller's words, we define happiness as whole person well-being. Bringing together the two phrases, whole person and well-being, we offer an even more succinct definition. Happiness is whole being. Wouldn't it be great if I could just respond, "It's whole being," when people ask me what happiness is? But it's not that simple, for two reasons. First, for this definition to be truly helpful and easy to apply to our lives, we're going to have to dissect whole person well-being on a more granular level, as we'll soon do. The second reason why this definition is not enough is because of a paradox inherent in our pursuit of happiness. The paradox of happiness. Becoming happier yields many benefits. Your physical immune system strengthens, relationships grow, productivity and creativity increase, and overall performance at work or in school improves. Even without all these benefits, the value of happiness lies in the fact that it simply feels good to feel good. It's in our nature to seek pleasure, avoid pain, and want to experience the flutter of joy rather than the weight of suffering. But there's a real problem. Studies suggest there is harm in placing too much value on happiness or on becoming happy. UC Berkeley psychologist Iris Mouse, and subsequently others, showed that people for whom happiness is very important, who claim happiness is a key value of mine, end up being less happy and feel lonelier in the world. Constantly reminding yourself how important happiness is and how much you want it can backfire. This is the paradox of happiness. The more we value it and therefore want it, the more elusive it is. If we're trying to become happier, then how do we resolve this paradox? Maybe self-deception? Do we fool ourselves by pretending we don't care, while secretly deep down we do? Do we tell ourselves, "I don't want to be happy," wink wink? This gets complicated. Fortunately, there is a solution. We can pursue happiness indirectly. If I wake up in the morning and say to myself, "I want to be happy, I'm going to be happy, no matter what," I am directly pursuing happiness. This deliberate pursuit to be happy reminds me how important happiness is to me, of how much I value it, and therefore hurts more than it helps. So what does it mean to indirectly pursue happiness? Instead of working at happiness itself, we can pursue the elements that lead to happiness. This way, our focus is on the value of these elements, rather than the value of happiness. Let's try an analogy. Think about sunlight, vital for life on Earth. What happens if you look directly at the sun? It hurts your eyes. It's damaging. You could even go blind. So how can you enjoy seeing the sun? You can look at it indirectly and view sunlight through a prism, which breaks it into its components, the colors, making a rainbow. You can then look at and enjoy what's right in front of you. So too with happiness. Directly pursuing happiness will lead to unhappiness. This is what Iris Mouse and others found. In contrast, indirectly pursuing happiness, first breaking it down into its elements and then pursuing those elements, is the path to actually becoming happier. In the words of 19th century philosopher John Stuart Mill, "Those only are happy who have their minds fixed on some object other than their own happiness." Now the important question for us is, what are these other objects that we should focus on? What are the metaphorical colors of the rainbow that make up whole person well-being that we can pursue, that will indirectly lead us to the light? Climbing the spire. In developing a way to happiness, combing through the intellectual history of the world and assembling ideas from poets to philosophers, theologians to scientists, economists to psychologists, my colleagues and I have identified 5 core elements that indirectly lead to happiness: spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional well-being. These elements each contribute to whole person well-being and are key to attaining more happiness. They make up the acronym SPIRE. Spiritual well-being. Are we living mindfully and purposefully? Spiritual well-being is about finding a sense of meaning and purpose. It can certainly be religious, however. It doesn't have to be. A banker who considers her work a calling can experience greater spiritual well-being than a monk who finds his work devoid of meaning. We also experience spiritual well-being when we're present in the here and now, rather than being distracted by the then and there. When we're mindful, we elevate ordinary experiences into extraordinary ones. Physical well-being. Do we take care of our bodies? This is about the mind-body connection and the impact they have on each other. Physical well-being is about taking care of ourselves through activities like exercise and through inactivity in the form of rest and recovery. We nourish our physiological and psychological well-being when we eat healthfully and touch lovingly. Intellectual well-being. Are we challenged and curious? We need to exercise our mind and learn new things. One of the silver linings of the pandemic was that many of us, spending more time at home, had more time to engage in intellectual development and growth. Research shows that people who constantly ask questions and are eager to learn are not just happier, but are also healthier. In fact, curiosity contributes to longevity. Relational well-being. Do we nurture connections that nurture us? The number one predictor of happiness is quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. We are social animals and need to connect, to belong. But it's not just about relationships with others. It's also about our relationship with ourselves. Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, once said, "All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone." Isolation doesn't have to be isolating, and we'll look at how to cultivate healthier and happier relationships, even when apart from loved ones. Emotional well-being. Are our feelings both honored and balanced? What do we do with painful emotions when they arise, which they inevitably will? How do we cultivate more pleasurable emotions, like joy, gratitude, and excitement? And how can we reside on higher planes of well-being for longer rather than merely enjoy temporary peaks? These are the five elements that together make up SPIRE, which we'll delve into in this book. SPIRE is a fitting word. One meaning of spire is the highest point of a building, like that of a church tower. Happiness is the highest point that we aim for, the star that we aspire to reach. Spire also means breath. Happiness gives us breath and increases our energy, engagement, and motivation. Altogether, the elements of spire inspire us to live our best life, a happier life. What about financial well-being? Recently, someone said to me, "You need to add a sixth element to SPIRE, financial well-being." And he was not the first one to suggest it. When I tell my students about SPIRE, typically someone asks, "What about money?" This person even went a step further. He noted, "You could call it affluential well-being, and then you'll have a SPIRE. You'll still have a nice acronym." And I did think about it. The reason I did not add affluential well-being and go with aspire is because, as I see it, financial well-being is already incorporated into spire. The five spire elements are primary characteristics of the person, while financial well-being is secondary. What do philosophers have to say about this hierarchy of primary and secondary characteristics? Aristotle, for example, refers to people as rational animals. That's intellectual well-being. Viktor Frankl and the existentialists talk about us as meaning-seeking animals. That's spiritual well-being. John Donne wrote, "No man is an island." We are relational animals who need companionship with other people. Emotions, of course, are an essential part of being human. And we don't need Sigmund Freud or David Hume to convince us of that. And when it comes to physical well-being, it's about nurturing the animal part of our being, which is most certainly part of our essence, as in rational animals.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?